So before we get to this midweek podcast, I gotta ask, you thinking about making a donation to some nonprofit thing that really matters to you, given, well, you know, the situation we're facing? And here's a follow-up. Would you donate to us? We could really use it. In fact, we rely on it. It's easy. Just go to onthemedia.org/donate or text the letters OTM to the number 69866. 69866. We'll send you a link where you can donate in just a few seconds. You know, sometimes this enterprise can feel like putting a message in a bottle and throwing it into the sea. It would be great to know you're out there. Okay, we have a friend, Alicia Zuckerman, who runs Miami's public radio newsroom. And she wrote recently on Facebook that in just about every Miami newsroom, every vacation, weekend, and holiday plan has come with the caveat, unless Castro dies. Well, this weekend, the tradition ended, along with Fidel. Now, rumors of Castro's death have circulated before. He was rumored to be dead a couple of years before he assumed power. That is, until a crucial interview in the jungle. The story goes like this. It's February 1957. Ruby Phillips, longtime Cuba correspondent for the New York Times, is approached by Castro's comrades. He wants to give an interview. Phillips declines. Cuba had become her home, and she knew she'd be deported. At the very least, she'd hurt her access to the increasingly repressive government of Fulgencio Batista. But she cabled the Times and urged Herbert L. Matthews, former war reporter turned editorial writer, to do it. He'd been there before and was eager for adventure, so he went. That's essentially where New York Times reporter Anthony DePalma's story takes off, as he relates in his book called The Man Who Invented Fidel, Castro, Cuba, and Herbert L. Matthews of the New York Times. DePalma told us a few years back that Matthews was both the best and the worst person for the job. He wrote vividly, but he had a dangerous tendency to fall in love with the causes and the characters he covered.
When he was covering the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, Abyssinia then, in the early 1930s, he believed that Mussolini was doing a great thing. He later on retracted that. When he covered the Spanish Civil War, he believed that the side that he was covering, which were the loyalists, were the side of righteousness. And then in 1957, he shows up in Cuba and interviews Fidel. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. He's been up all night. He's muddy and cold. Dawn is just breaking in the Sierra. And Fidel comes through the foliage like some apparition.
What was the kind of stage management that Castro applied to the scene?
They're basically sitting on a log for 3 hours. And he lays out an image of himself as a young, democracy-loving defender of the Cuban Constitution. He says that he's got a number of men with him, armed with telescopic rifles. They've got Batista on the run. The truth is, he had 18 men at most. He had one telescopic rifle. He has his brother, Raul, send over someone and say, Comandante, we're getting a report from the second column. Of course, with 18 men, there was no second column. But in defense of Matthews, he had checked with the U.S. Embassy in Havana. They told him hundreds of men. We had run a story citing the rebel representative in New York saying they had hundreds of men. And our resident correspondent, Ruby Phillips, who had lived in Cuba for 30 years, said, we believe he's up there and has several hundred men behind him.
Matthews returns to New York. He writes a 3-part series. Batista was famously censoring the press. And in fact, those papers, when they arrived, literally had the stories clipped out of them. Mm-hmm. But an anti-Batista character was dispatched to New York to buy up the papers, clip those stories out, and send them to thousands of very important people in Cuba.
I spoke to that man. Mario Llerena is the man's name. He's now in his 90s. He was a supporter of Fidel's. He was called in by another one of the supporters and said, we need you to go to New York. He handed him the money for the ticket and a copy of the social registry of Havana.
So they went to a great deal of trouble to get the story to the Cuban people. What was the impact?
Just last week, I spoke to someone who was there at the time. He's now an academic in New York, and he said it was electric. Here was the first real news that he was alive. It was coming from a source outside of Cuba, so it was trusted. Castro's image in Cuba at that time was a little bit of a roughneck. He had gone through a couple of other attempts at overthrowing the government that failed utterly. But here he was being presented as a leader, as a romantic figure. Remember, he was only 30 years old. He was young. He had a beard. He had these men up in the mountains.
So he was made a hero by Matthews. But wasn't Matthews made into something of a hero by Castro as well?
Absolutely. Matthews, remember, 57-year-old editorial writer at the newspaper, one day had to go through the doors of the New York Times on 43rd Street in Manhattan and pass by a demonstration supporting the articles that he wrote. Probably made it pretty embarrassing for him to deal with his colleagues.
And in fact, you write that he was already in a peculiar position of writing both for the news pages and the editorial pages. He kept saying, "Trust me, I'm a great asset to your paper." But by dint of writing his opinion in one section of the paper and what was ostensibly objective news in another part of the paper, he couldn't be trusted in either section.
It was a dangerous precedent that was never repeated. The New York Times didn't back away from it. In fact, they used his position as editorial writer and correspondent in advertisements, and they were very proud of what he did. When Castro turned and showed that his revolution was intent on becoming a communist revolution, people looked for someone to blame, and Matthews was the target. Blamed by Cubans who didn't like Fidel, blamed by our United States Senate in congressional hearings, blamed by the journalistic community.
Do you think he deserved that blame?
A professor at Stanford said that blaming Matthews for Castro is like blaming the meteorologist for a storm. Even today, 50 years later, people are writing biographies of Castro, and they still can't say with any real authority whether or not Castro was a communist at the time in 1957 that he did the interview. We still don't know. Did he make mistakes? Absolutely. Did he do things that the newspaper, the New York Times, should not have allowed through? Absolutely. Do I, as a longtime staff member of the New York Times, feel proud about everything that he did? Absolutely not. What I was simply trying to do was to look at the story behind the myth, and I found that there was far more myth than there was truth to it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
New York Times reporter Anthony DePalma is author of The Man Who Invented Fidel, Castro, Cuba, and Herbert L. Matthews of the New York Times. As DePalma says, myths about Cuba abound, and also clichés. So much so, in fact, that when you listen to Cuba coverage, you'd be forgiven for thinking that there's a style guide specifically made for covering it. Well, if there isn't one, we're making it now. First of all, how to describe the location of Cuba. You could say a small island in the Caribbean, or probably just assume that most people know where it is. But that would be to neglect the key factor of any Cuba story, namely its relation to the United States. If only there were a way to mention the U.S. while cleverly juxtaposing the geographical proximity with the ideological distance.
Cuba lies just 90 miles from Miami, but worlds apart.
The two countries that are separated by a mere 90 miles, but worlds apart.
Countries separated by a mere 90 miles, though seemingly worlds apart.
Countries separated by a mere 90 miles, but seemingly worlds apart.
Check. Now, as to covering the island itself, we'll need to dust off our Cuba reporting glossary. Luckily, there's just a handful of words every reporter needs to know, like the magic word that describes, well, just about everything about Cuba.
But just about every traveler that I've spoken to while I've been here notices one thing. Cuba's crumbling buildings.
Cuba's crumbling infrastructure.
Cuba's crumbling economy.
Cuba's crumbling coastline.
Cuba's crumbling capital.
The long-time media blackout that's about to crumble in Cuba. Charlie breaks that story right here.
And if you get tired of crumbling, mix it up with a heaping helping of decay.
Of the beauty and decay of Havana.
Some may see only decay and ruin here, but others see opportunity.
He'll move among the monuments of Washington and the gleaming towers of New York. Quite a difference from the decaying streets he traveled here in Cuba.
Why all the decay and crumbling? Because Cuba is no regular country. In fact, it doesn't even exist in the same space-time continuum as we do. Rather,
Cuba is a nation frozen in time.
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 The closest thing to time travel.
Island frozen in time.
Stuck in a time warp, thousands of vintage American cars still rolling down the streets of Cuba.
Ah, yes, the cars. No Cuba story is complete without a reference to their famous cars. And not just any cars.
Havana is known for its vintage cars.
Massive fleets of vintage American cars.
Vintage cars clogging the streets and slums lining the roads.
Now, obviously, Cuban culture isn't defined by only one thing. Actually, it's defined by four things. In addition to cars, they have rum and cigars.
Speaking of Cuba, rum, cigars, anyone?
A new era for the U.S. and Cuba, from politics to cigars, even rum.
Cuba. Come for the rum and cigars, stay for the human rights abuses.
And of course, music.
There is always plenty of action on the streets of Havana.
A rhythm-infused culture known for its classic cars and cigars.
Look past the grand colonial buildings with their crumbling columns and peeling plaster, and you'll find the city's beating heart.
All of which has made Cuba into something of a... What's that word?
Cuba has been this forbidden fruit for the American traveler.
This forbidden fruit of the Caribbean was a vacationer's paradise.
For years, it's been the forbidden fruit of Caribbean travel.
Cuba has long been the forbidden fruit of the Caribbean. History freeze frame.
Now, before you go criticizing the press, try to keep in mind, they can't help it.
Walking through the streets of Havana, you can't help but get the sense of being in a bit of a time warp.
Well, as you walk down the streets, you can't help but notice the classic American cars like this old Chevy.
So when you think of Cuba, you can't help but thinking about cigars. Cuban cigars are interrelated.
That's almost it for our Cuba reporting style guide. Except one more thing, and it's the most important point of all. How you end a piece about Cuba. Obviously, you need music, but what? Something traditional sounding? But not too traditional, something catchy. But also recognizable to a non-Cuban audience. Something that just screams Cuba to non-Cubans. Something like... Buena Vista Social Club. Perfect. You've been listening to an On the Media podcast extra. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.